thanks. Thanks for the opportunity to come and spend a couple of weeks here. It's been fun so far. Okay, so like quite a few people in this room, I've been interested in looking at the glass transition in supercooled liquids. And a couple of years ago, soon after the last time I was here for an extended time, the jamming workshop, I started playing around with dimer models. And fortunately, at that time, Yanni Kondev joined the department as a young faculty member. So Yanni and I have been working on looking at dimer models or various versions of it with the intention of understanding some aspects of glassy dynamics, and I'll specify exactly what we've been interested in. So my collaborator, Dibendu Das, was a postdoc, and he's done all the simulations that I'll talk about. And Yanni and I, as I said, we've been working on this together for a couple of years now. The last part of the talk where I'll talk about an exact solution which shows that there's a vocal culture divergence wouldn't have happened if Satya Majumdar hadn't visited for a week at the end of May. Okay, so what I'm going to focus on in this talk is trying to understand the rapid divergence of timescales as you approach the glass transition. So the whole issue of aging and the glassy phase, I'm not going to address at all. At the end of the talk, I'll try to say that maybe this model would have some interesting things to say about that too, but it's not part of the talk. So just focusing on this picture, so this is just reproduced from a paper by Gilles Tarjus. It's a compilation of experimental data. And so the dramatic feature that everyone agrees upon, and I believe there is no true understanding of, is the rapid divergence of timescales as you approach the glass transition. Is there a pointer?
Fraction of a pointer.
OK. So if you look at either the timescales or the viscosity, then if you had standard activated dynamics, it would follow the Arrhenius law, which is the straight line here. But then what you see is this pronounced curvature in a certain class of glasses, which I'll be focusing on, which are called the fragile glasses. So the timescale goes up much more rapidly than Arrhenius. And you can, a good description of the going up of this timescale can be provided by the Vogel-Fulcher law, which essentially says that the timescale diverges exponentially at some temperature. A different way of looking at it is extracting the barriers out of the timescales that I was showing you before. And if the barriers were constant, I would get an Arrhenius law. If you look at these barriers, which are plotted here, then it shows that the barriers are going up rapidly. So the question that we were interested in is, so there's been long discussions about what kind of a transition this is. Is it a pure dynamic transition? Is there an underlying thermodynamic phase transition occurring in these supercooled liquids near the glass transition? So we thought we could formulate a very specific question and try to address that in a simple model, which is, can you find a critical point which has diverging barriers or which has activated critical dynamics in a non-disordered model? So in disordered models like the random fieldizing model, it's known that the timescales go up exponentially or the barriers diverge at the critical point. But as far as we know, there were no previous demonstrations of a non-disordered, non-quench random critical point where the dynamics went up exponentially. So if you look at a power law, the dynamical exponent Z was infinite and it went up exponentially. So that was the question. The question was, can we find a model which did this? And if it did, then one could argue that maybe even in this real supercooled liquid, there is such an underlying thermodynamic transition. It might not exist completely. It might get destroyed by other effects that we don't have. But maybe it's lurking there underneath the observation somehow. So So the question was this. So if I have a critical point where the correlation length diverges as usual as a parallel, but the relaxation time diverges as an exponent of the correlation length, then one could argue that maybe the reason that, so one of the features of the glass transition is no one sees any diverging length scale. The reason could be that this is diverging so much more slowly than that, that you fall out of equilibrium way above the place where you could actually see any reasonable changes in this correlation length. So that's the scenario that we would like to explore in a simple model, that can you get this scenario in a model which doesn't have quench randomness. Okay, so the idea was not really ours, it was, we were following up essentially on a proposition by Jim Sethna from around 1984, where he argued that maybe the glass transition in supercooled liquids can be understood from such a scenario, where I have a frustration temperature phase diagram, and maybe at zero temperature, I have a critical point, which would then necessarily have diverging barriers at the critical point, and maybe this is an attractive fixed point. So this line, any point here would flow towards this critical point, so the glass transition where I would be crossing this line would be controlled by this critical point. So this was just a proposition, but we were inspired by that in looking for the kinds of lattice models we're looking for. So what I'll show you today is that we do have a similar scenario where we look at a lattice model with constraints, and I'll explain what the model is in a minute. And what we find is that instead of looking at a frustration temperature phase diagram, if I look at a phase diagram where this is some coupling constant, and there is some constraint that's rigidly enforced along this line, then along this line we do find a critical point which has this activated behavior. Whether this critical point is attractive or not, that we don't know yet. So this part of the phase diagram we have nothing to say about so far. But what I'll show you is along this line we do have a transition, a critical point, and as I approach this critical point my time scales diverge as a Vogel-Fulcher law. Okay, so outline of the talk. So it all began with doing simulation. So I'm going to give you an outline of the lattice model and the simulation results. Then I'll show you how we constructed an effective coarse grain dynamics for the order parameter of this model. And I'll spend a few minutes talking about that because I think that approach can actually be useful even in other systems. And finally, so from the coarse grain dynamics, we can argue about whether the divergence is Vogel-Fulcher like, what is the actual form of the correlation functions, etc. And then at the end, I'll show you a continuum model where we can actually work out what the exact results are near the critical point. And then I'll say a few things about connections to trap-like models that have been in the literature. And then I'll end by maybe making some predictions and talking about future work. Okay, so the model that we have is the three coloring model. So this evolved from the work that I was doing about 5 years ago on dimers. So I have a hexagonal lattice and I have three colors, and the constraint that I have is that every vertex I have to have all three colors meeting. So I cannot have two greens or two blues or two reds meeting at any vertex. So that's a rigidly enforced constraint on the model. So I'm looking at all coloring configurations where this constraint is rigidly enforced. In talking about this model, it's useful to go to a mapping where you can take all the possible three color configurations. And I should say, so if you just look at this, I can construct many, many coloring configurations, and the number of coloring configurations grows exponentially with the system size, so these things have a finite entropy. There's a height model that one can map these three color ensembles to, which I'll describe quickly. If anyone is interested in later on, I can go into the details. But it's a two-component height. So the height field lives in two dimensions. And I can describe it by three different directions in this height world. And the rule for the heights is if I have, let's say, a triangle pointing downwards, and if I cross the red bond going in this direction, then the height goes up in that direction. If I cross the green bond going in this direction, then I go up by B. I don't know why I have the A in here. So if I cross the green bond, I go A plus B. And then if I go back again, I add another A bond, it comes back to the same point. So coming back, I always end up with the same height configuration as long as I don't violate the constraint. So it gives me a well-defined height map where the height has two components. So all the coloring configurations can be then displayed as an interface. And I'm just showing you one of the height components now. So the height field itself has two components. I'm just showing you one because that's going to be important in what we're talking about. Yeah. Say that again. No. The magnitude of these vectors? No, they're the same. They're vectors, right? So think of a height that I can just like it. I have a height vector in two dimensions, and it's as if it lives on a triangular lattice. Okay, so I can just have two independent
vectors.
Height is a two-dimensional vector, right. And I'm showing you only one of the components now, which you can then think of. So at the center of each of these, there are two vectors sitting. Does that make sense? So at every point, there is a two-dimensional, there's a vector. There's a height vector. And I'm plotting only one component of it, which is then, you can think of as just a scalar, a number. Right, so let's say I'm just plotting the A component here. Okay, so then on every point on the lattice, this is what I'll say. So generically, if I pick up a color configuration, I'm likely to get a height configuration where the height is completely flat but is very rough. So in the height language, and Yanni has worked on this for his thesis, etc. Lots of people, other people have worked on it too. All of these are in the height language, the field theory is completely a Gaussian theory. So there is nothing preferring any height. There are no tilts preferred, but you have a very rough surface. So depends on which. No, this is B, right?
Yeah, but you had H plus A, so plus.
Oh, that's right. Sorry. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yes. So I have H plus A plus.
H plus
A plus B. Yes. Exactly. Right. Right. A plus B plus C, which is comes back to H. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Good. So this has all been sort of known. The entropy was calculated by Baxter a long time ago. What we were interested in seeing is can we introduce an energy function in the system? So far, all of the coloring configurations have the same energy, right? So there is either an energy associated with violating the constraint, which is infinite, or there's no energy at all. So all the coloring configurations have equal weight. If I introduce an energy function into the system which prefers, say, certain coloring configurations, then maybe we'll be able to introduce a phase transition in the model as a function of that energy coupling. And then that's what we wanted to look at. We wanted to investigate that phase transition. Am I making sense? Okay. That's right. But then that constraint is rigidly enforced. That constraint we don't violate at all.
That's the only constraint.
That's the only constraint. Yeah. Okay. So we introduce an energy which depends only on the global tilt. So if I go back here, if I make this surface tilt up, so this is at one point in the height space, and this is at another point, we introduce an energy function which would prefer such a tilt only in one component of the height. So in the coloring language, what that corresponds to is I can pick one of the colors, say green, red, or blue, and say that all, let me pick the blue ones, that all the blue ones want to line up in the same direction. So if all the blue bonds lined up in the same direction, then every time I cross the blue bond, I would be going up by the height component C, and I would keep marching up, so the height would tilt up. So the energy function that we introduce is this sort of very mean field kind of energy, which says, if the tilt, it just depends on the global tilt. So it's a very mean field-like model. So the energy function depends on the global tilt, and it would like to tilt the model. Where this energy came from is sort of historical, but let's forget about it now. So the energy would like to tilt the surface, but the entropy of this model, which is known, and I put the known in quotation marks because it's exactly known for the two-color version of this, for all tilts. For the three-color version, there are arguments as to what it should look like, but I'll just sketch it for you. So the entropy, so what I'm asking now is, if I force the surface to have a given tilt, how many possible colorings do I have? And the logarithm of that is my entropy. So the entropy has a maximum at zero tilt and goes down. So entropically, the state that's favored is the flat surface, which is very rough, which is why it has a high entropy. Energetically, the system would like to sit here, which has the highest tilt. Okay, so the competition between these two drives our usual mean field-like phase transition, so the thermodynamics can be worked out exactly. Okay, so the thermodynamics, I can just write down a free energy, which is this, minus S of rho. Rho is my order parameter, and I can just because it's mean field, I can just minimize it, and it tells me what the tilt is as a function of this coupling constant mu. So this is my coupling constant. Okay, so we have a usual kind, so the thermodynamics of this model is known exactly, and what would happen is, as a function of mu, as I cranked up mu, for mu less than mu star, I have this disordered rough interface, which in the coloring language, I have colors which are essentially, I have one-third, one-third, one-third of each color along in every direction. And I end up in the ordered state for mu greater than mu star, where all the blue bonds are lined up exactly parallel to each other. Yeah?
It seems like
true, yeah. Yeah, the linear function gives you a Pokrovsky-Talapov-like transition, and I wasn't going to talk about it today, but we've looked at that too. It turns out the dynamics of the Pokrovsky-Talapov is less interesting than the dynamics of this, but... Sure. Am I hitting these things? That's true. That's true, yeah. So, but, you know, Claudia has been playing around with making this interaction local now, so you're right. But the linear one is not so interesting dynamically, so we gave up on that.
But you believe that the more interesting features are, they don't require non-locality?
I believe that the interesting features don't require the non-locality, okay? And we can talk more about that, yeah. So let me go to the end, and then I think it'll hopefully be clear why I believe that.
Actually, the linear term is more like a chemical potential.
That's right. So that gives you a Pokrovsky-Talapov-like transition. The transition is still not the usual garden variety transition. Because the ordered state has zero entropy, right? So it's a completely frozen state. So the only excitations are these non-zero winding number loop. So in the high, if I have a gradient H square without the energy coupling and then I put in a chemical potential, it becomes like a Pokrovsky-Talapov transition. Okay, but yes?
So I'm still confused. If you're, what is the microscopic Wilsonian that you, because I could think about other terms, whether you have cubic invariance or not, so you can have.
Okay, so let me tell you how we got to that. All of these coloring configurations you can think of as ground states of some spin models, right? So if you take those original spin models and couple them to long-range lattice distortions, so you make the lattice compressible. So you have spin models which are frustrated, and then you make the lattice distortion compressible. You don't start off with an infinite range, but if you make it coupled only to very long wavelength variations of the strain field, you can make it infinite range. And those then, if you write in the ensemble of only the ground states, gives you this energy function. So you take the original spin Hamiltonian, which you can write down exactly, couple it to lattice distortions, and then you say, I'm going to look at this, the whole model, only within the ensemble of ground states of the spins. Okay, can we, so it's one of these, okay. So there is actually a first order phase transition with the quadratic, so with the linear term, as I was saying, it's a Pokrovsky-Talapov transition. With the quadratic energy function that I have, and so with this energy function, what happens is actually you have a first order phase transition going from the flat state to the tilted state. I'll draw the free energy for you for in a second. And okay, so why don't I draw that? Can anyone see it if I draw it here? Okay. So if I just draw the free energy as a function of the entropy, so this is just the energy minus the entropy term for different values of mu. So, and I'm going to draw only one side of this. So for small values of mu, you have only one minimum. And I'm going to shift the different curves. So as I increase mu, what happens is a minimum starts developing. So rho equal to 1 is my maximally tilted surface. So you can think of this as a first order phase transition. But because it's mean field, these barriers grow up with system size, so the nucleation never happens. But if I go to a lower temperature or a higher value of mu, then what happens is at a certain critical value of mu, which is what I'm calling mu star, this is what happens. So I lose this barrier. I lose this barrier, and so it's one. So if I think of the order parameter is going to jump from 0 to 1, but I still have an instability. So all of the susceptibilities, etc., diverge. So it's. Does that answer your question? So I do have a first order transition, but below that, because it's mean field, I have an instability. Okay, because the barrier goes away. So for my purposes, the first order transition is complete.
Sorry.
Yeah.
This curve that in the window.
This one.
No. Yeah.
No, the entropy is not quadratic. The entropy is not quadratic.
Yeah, but I'm saying that you would like probably the very cubic invariance and the free energy expansion.
The free energy has lots of other terms in rho because the entropy is not quadratic in rho.
But you're drawing free energy as a function of rho.
Rho. Yes, the energy is quadratic, but the entropy is not.
Yeah, the entropy is linear,
right? No. No. The entropy has lots of other terms in it, okay? Yeah, so the only thing that's important for us to know for the entropy is that it has a maximum at rho equal to 0, the leading term is quadratic, and then it goes to 0 linearly at rho equal to 1. Okay? But it's a complicated function. I didn't even write it down. Okay? So it's not, the free energy is not quadratic. But as I'll argue at the end of the talk, since we completely, this part, the fact that there's a first order transition is not relevant for the dynamics at all, you could take a quadratic free energy function and you would recover most of the dynamical features that we're talking about. Okay, so the transition that we're talking about then in the Hyde language is going from a rough, flat surface to this completely tilted but no roughness at all surface. So it's a tilting transition from here to here. So for the rest of the talk, what I'll be interested in is looking at what is the dynamics as I approach this critical point. Okay, I'm not looking at what happens below, I'm just asking, how do I approach this critical point and what happens to the timescales? Okay, so the first thing I do is be very pragmatic and come up with a Monte Carlo scheme which will let me explore. So I need some moves. I need some moves that will let me go from here to here. Okay, and that, as you'll see, the constraints make that slightly tricky. So the first stuff that I'll talk about is just Monte Carlo simulations, and then I'll progressively go to constructing more analytical models. Okay, so the first thing to notice is how do I go about exploring the color configuration. So because of the constraint that no two colors can meet at a point, I cannot do color exchanges or I cannot shift colors, right? So if I take the red one and put it here, I'm going to violate the constraint. So the simplest possible moves that one can do are involve loops in this space. So you can convince yourself that because of this constraint, if I follow a particular pair of colors, so blue and red here, that they form closed loops on the system. Right, so if I follow red, blue, they have to necessarily form closed loops, or they can form loops that go around my system if I have periodic boundary conditions. So this is one particular loop, and the dynamics that we can use to explore all of the coloring configurations is one where I just pick such a loop and then just slide the colors around it. So wherever I had a red, I shift it to the blue. So I just take this coloring configuration, and if I update this loop, I get a new coloring configuration. And I do this for loops of any arbitrary size. And so in the Monte Carlo scheme is that you go to a bond, pick a loop, and then just update it. And you take it or reject it depending on the energy function, just as you would do in any other Monte Carlo scheme. Okay, so this is one particular loop, but then we do it for all possible loops on the system. Well, there is no other way of doing it. You cannot take, or this is the simplest way of doing it. So the smallest one you can do is take a hexagon, the smallest loop that exists, and do it this way. Right, you cannot exchange the colors. In the height language, what we are doing is if the height had a peak in the center of this loop. So let me backtrack for a second. These loops that I'm talking about are actually contour levels of the height. And so if I do this loop update, then what you do to the height configuration is if you had a hill, you split it to a valley, and the other way around. Okay, so the dynamics that we're using, in some sense, is like a cluster algorithm or something that flips heights over arbitrary large regions. Yeah, all of them are chosen. All of them are chosen. Okay, equally well. Any two color loops are chosen and updated. Okay, so there's no bias. But I'm saying you have to choose loops. Okay? Okay, if you stare at this for just a second, you can see that, okay, I can do these loop updates, which will change my color configuration, but it doesn't do anything to the tilt. Let's say the tilt involves the blue bonds. I had blue bonds pointing, I had three of these pointing in this direction, two here, two along this direction. That number is conserved by the loop update. So these loop updates actually cost me zero energy. So the only loops that can change the tilt are loops which with our periodic boundary conditions, when this thing lives on a torus, are loops that wrap around the system. So these are non-zero winding number loops. So if I was doing a quantum version of this model, then of course, these would not be allowed because there will be no there are no matrix elements of my Hamiltonian connecting, say, one tilt to another. So I would always be stuck in one tilt state. But I know my phase transition involves tilting, so I necessarily have to put this in to be able to even reach that configuration where the system goes from a flat state to a tilted state. So the upshot of this is we update these loops too. So loops with non-zero winding numbers also get updated. But now, when I update these loops, there can be an energy cost or an energy gain associated with it. So if I put it, the energy prefers larger tilt, so it wants to put more and more loops in. So is the dynamics clear? So we do small loop updates and non-zero winding number loop updates.
In the quantum problem, you can imagine the equivalent of Planck transverse field in the map to the screen. You don't get infinite loops because you have to go to very high order. But in the classical model, you know, if you put loop dynamics by hand saying, okay, this is the dynamics, that's one thing. But if you imagine that you had that constraint that you softened, you have...
Then I would never go to the other tilt states.
You would never go for the same reason because you would have to...
Right, I am...
And then recombine the defect.
I understand. So I'm sort of putting in by hand a dynamic that will let me explore all the tilt states.
Yeah, but you could ask, well, is this natural? If you have the model coming from a soft constraint,
then I don't have to do this. Then I can put in defects, and I can.
You have to wait for the defects to break and recombine it to go in. So it would slow down the dynamics too. So wouldn't it be natural to put a term that's in your Monte Carlo, an energy cost for the update?
That's what we did initially. That was the first thing we did. Right. The first thing we did was not even look in this ensemble. Right. I violated the constraint. I had defects, and the dynamics was extremely slow. So what I thought was by doing this, I would speed up the dynamics. Yeah, but even the accelerated dynamics is slow, is what I'm going to convince you of, right? So this is an accelerated dynamics, and I, you know, if the accelerated dynamics had no slowness in it, I wouldn't be talking about it. So even the accelerated dynamics is extremely slow.
Yeah, but then accelerated, it allows you to tilt, whereas the other one
would allow you to tilt. If I put in defects, it would allow me to tilt because that's the lowest energy state.
Because you would have to, you have to go over the.
No, it doesn't. No, you can create two defects and it'll, you can create multiple defects and they just zip.
They have to zip. So how long it takes to go over the defects?
Yeah, so that time scale might go up, right? But the interesting thing is, even if that time scale goes up, there is a divergence of the time scale at the critical point. I can scale all my time scales out by that system-dependent time scale. Okay? But if you think of this as a very accelerated algorithm, and that's sort of how we came to it. We thought this would accelerate everything, and we would be able to reach the critical point. But doesn't happen. Okay. Okay, so this is the dynamic. So for the next couple of slides, I'm going to show you some simulation results. Okay, so the tilt is what we are monitoring for all of these in the simulations. The tilt is the primary thing that we monitor. So I'm just showing you a couple of sample trajectories for different mu's. Okay, so for small mu, if I look at the tilt as a function of time, so this is my Monte Carlo time, it fluctuates about zero, there's nothing very interesting going on. If I go to larger mu's, then you see these very plateau-like dynamics where things get stuck for a while. And this is, remember, this is with the loop dynamics. This is updating all the non-zero winding number loops. So this stays stuck in some tilt state for a long time and do this. Okay, so we measured all the sort of the standard quantities. The most interesting one to look at is this tilt-tilt autocorrelation function. So I'll show you that as a function of mu. And then we'll proceed to constructing the coarse grain dynamics. So these are the tilt-tilt autocorrelation functions. So this is like looking at a magnetization autocorrelation function, and mu is increasing this one. So you sort of see these characteristic features where as mu goes up, you start developing a plateau, and then it decays at longer times. So if you measure the time scale of these plateaus and plot it up, then they seem to go up more stronger than any power law, or in small power law you can try and fit it. So if I measure just these timescales, then they seem to go up, diverge at the mu star that we obtained from our thermodynamic considerations, and diverge with either a very large power or exponentially. We cannot make it out from the simulations. But it looked like the dynamics was extremely slow. So that was our first biggest surprise, because I thought with the non-zero winding number loops, this dynamics will really speed up. But it didn't. So as you approach this critical point, which has to do with the tilting transition, the dynamics slows down dramatically. Okay, so then we really wanted to ask where the slowing down was coming from. So what we wanted to do, what we proceeded to do, was construct an effective dynamics for the tilt itself. Right, so here the microscopic dynamics has to do with the loops, which is changing the color configuration. Can we sort of coarse grain all of that and then just come out with some kind of master equation, Fokker-Planck equation for just the tilt, and see what that looks like? Okay, so to do that, we looked at our simulation and asked several questions. So I'm going to go through them one by one. So the simulations that Dibendu now did was he would start from the state in a given tilt, run his Monte Carlo simulations, and ask several questions. So the first question you can ask is, what is the probability that the system stays in this tilt after a certain time t? And that probability you find decays exponentially with a characteristic time tau rho. Okay, so if I start from a tilt for a tilt which is 1 and ask how long, ask what is the probability that stays in this state after a certain time t, it decays with a probability, it decays exponentially with a characteristic time scale. So the first, again, surprise here was this characteristic time scale grows exponentially with rho. Now, why is that a surprise? So I'm still in the disordered state where rho equal to 0 is my thermodynamic equilibrium. So that's where the system wants to relax. So if I just had, imagine just thinking of an Ising model, so I have some kind of Ginzburg-Landau free energy surface, I'm sitting at a very high magnetization, that actually relaxes faster than a low magnetization because the drift term is huge. Here, that doesn't happen. The time scale seems to grow as rho increases. So that was our first, that was Dibendu's first measurement, and then we said, okay, let's ask even more specific questions, and let's ask for the rates that if I start from, and I'm multiplying the tilt by L now, which is the system size, so the tilt is discrete, it goes, increases by, every time I put in a non-zero winding number loop, it increases by 1 over L. So this thing is integers, goes from 0 to L. So what's the rate of transition from a tilt, L rho, to one that's lower than it? Okay, and so we extracted these rates, and the rates we found went down with mu, and this is increasing rho. Okay, so the rates decreased with rho and also decreased with mu. On the other hand, if you looked at the transition rates going from a tilt to one that's just higher than it, so the next possible higher tilt, they were essentially independent of mu, but again went down drastically as you increase the tilt itself. So all of these observations we could put together, fit them, so we knew the energy function and we knew the entropy function. And we also know that the dynamic satisfies detailed balance. That was built into our Monte Carlo simulations. So what we found was, if we looked at these transition rates for in the tilt space now, they do satisfy detailed balance, but it's a highly unusual partitioning of the rates. So to go from a tilt to one that's lower, it cost energy because the energy of the lower tilt states is higher. To go from a tilt to the next higher one, you have simply an entropy cost. So the ratio of this is still the free energy, which is, so it satisfies detailed balance, but you have energy on one side and entropy on the other side. And that, I'll argue, for the rest of the talk, is the source of all the slowing down. So why does that happen? If I just want to sort of come up with some qualitative argument as to why this makes sense in our model, let's start from a configuration where I have only one non-zero winding number loop. So if I know I have a tilt of one, then I have to have one non-zero winding number loop, because the height on this side is one step down from the height on that side. So if I have a non-zero winding number loop, and then I just want to go a step down, all I have to do is erase this loop, right? I know it exists, and I have to just erase this loop. And that costs me energy. So if I want to go this way, so I want to erase this loop, it's simply an energy cost, because this thing exists, and I sample that loop as I would sample any other small loop, and so the only thing that happens is it costs me energy. On the other hand, if I want to go this way, which means I need to put in another loop in the system, these loops, a characteristic that we know of these loops, especially when the tilt is close to zero, is that these loops are extremely rough. They take up a lot of space. So the size of the loops go as the system size to the 3/2. So these loops like to be rough. They don't like to be straight. So I have two options in trying to put in this second loop. One is trying to straighten this out and put in another one, which costs entropy. Or I can try and follow this loop, which is also highly unlikely. So putting in, remember, this is just arguments. I don't have any rigorous arguments to tell you that this has happened. This is what we observe. We get that numerically, that the rates do have this form, that this energy on one side and entropy on the other side. And if you think of the loop dynamics, it sort of makes sense. So going this way is going downhill in energy. Energetically, this is preferred, but there is a high cost entropically in putting these loops in. And the more loops I have, so now if I want to put the third one in, it costs even more because I have less and less space to put these non-zero winding number loops in. So essentially, it's like as I pack more of these loops in, I have lesser and lesser room to play around with to put the next one in. So the rates for going to higher tilts, which should have been high because energetically it's favorable to go that way, is completely blocked by this entropy cost. Okay, so this is where our simulation sort of ended. So we extracted all of these from the simulations. And so this now gives me a master equation for the tilt. So are there any questions at this point that I should? Okay, so for the rest of the talk, I'm just going to talk about this master equation and what we have extracted out of this. So the unusual feature is I have a dynamics which obeys detail balance, but it has this funny partitioning of the rates. Okay, so the first thing we do is we can actually look at the autocorrelation function once we have this master equation, and I can do a saddle point analysis. I can look at the asymptotic behavior of this correlation function, and it has this form. So it has a log t square with a mu star minus mu. So as mu approaches mu star, I get a plateau that sort of extends forever. Okay, and if you look at this correlation function, you plot it up, it's somewhere in between a stretch exponential and a power law. It's some slow function. This is what comes out of the saddle point analysis. So to argue about a Vogel, the first thing we tried to see is if this would give us Vogel Fulcher, and this is sort of the argument that for example, Bouchot uses, or one can use, saying, okay, so suppose I have some lower limit. So I can measure my correlation function only if it's the small but not zero, then that gives me a natural cutoff, so I can extract what is the tau that corresponds to this smallest correlation that I can see, which is the longest time scale. And given this, that time scale will diverge exponentially as 1 over mu star minus mu to the half. So I get something like a Vogel-Fulcher. If you're picky, it's not exactly Vogel-Fulcher, it's square root of mu star minus mu, but it's not a parallel. So the time scale from this, we would predict, would go up. So the other thing that we did, which I showed way back, and I'm not going to go back to it, is to see if this functional form fits the simulation results that we got before coarse-graining, and they do at long times. So not at short times, but at long times, it does. So we constructed this master equation, which had this energy-entropy kind of division, and because of that, we end up getting these very slow dynamics and a dynamics where the time scale seems to go exponentially as I approach this critical point. Okay, and it has all to do, so if I just took that free energy and wrote down a master equation where the partitioning wasn't that funny, then you could show that none of these funny dynamics would happen. So the constraints that I had, the constraints that I have no two colors meeting at a point, which forces me to go through the loop dynamics, creates this funny partitioning of the rights, okay, which goes energy and entropy. So then one could say, okay, is this a generic feature? If I come up with the dynamics, if I have a model where I have a usual critical point, so my dynamics obeys detailed balance, but it obeys detailed balance because of constraints, I have this funny partitioning of rates where if I'm going uphill in energy, it costs me energy. If I'm going downhill in energy, it costs me entropy. So I sort of have killed both ways. So the rates become very small going out of a particular state. Then generically, can we say something about that dynamics? Okay, so that's what I'm going to do for the next few minutes. So before I do that continuum equation, let me just quickly, again, give a cartoon of what I think is happening. So if I have this usual kind of dynamics, right, where I have detailed balance and I partition it in this very symmetric way, I have a critical point where the free energy flattens out in a very naive sort of Ginzburg-Landau way, then I know I get the usual critical slowing down. What's happening in this system is I can rewrite these rates. So the rates that I was writing as an exponential of negative delta E and exponential of negative delta S, I can rewrite in this symmetric form, but now I have these barriers sitting in front of it. So you can actually interpret this as a usual relaxational dynamics in a free energy well, but in this space of the tilts, I have barriers that are growing exponentially. So when I'm at small mu's, the system is feeling this free energy, so it spends most of its time down at the bottom. It doesn't sample the large barriers, but as the free energy flattens out, then I start sampling more and more of these larger barriers, and that leads to the exponential divergence of timescale. So that's a cartoonish picture. I'm going to even forget that. So what we decided to do was take the simplest possible free energy, which is just a quadratic free energy, put in these rates, which is delta E and delta S, and then look at that model in detail, where we can construct a continuum version and ask for the solution. So in the continuum model that I'll talk about in the next few minutes, I take just a quadratic free energy. So my free energy is just mu star minus mu times rho square. If I did my usual dynamics here, it's the garden variety. It's the simplest critical point slowing down that I can get. So all we do is take this, but then now put in these rates, which are delta E and delta S. So going up, I would have mu times rho square. Going down, I would have mu star times rho square. If you do that and write down the master equation, we can construct a well-defined continuum limit when the system size goes to infinity and I also am very close to the critical point, so mu approaching mu star. So this is the stuff that I did with Satya in the sort of the last week of May, so this is very, very new. Okay, so I'll just write down the continuum equation that we get. in terms of this variable, which is L times rho, so it goes from minus infinity to infinity, and lambda is my distance from the critical point. So I want to write down the equation because the equation itself is quite... So the final continuum equation that I get for the probability of finding a tilt x at time t is this. So lambda is the distance from the critical point. If I didn't have these terms, the exponential term sitting here, this would be your usual Fokker-Planck equation, would give me the usual Langevin dynamics for the variable x. So these terms come from this funny way of partitioning the rates. Okay, so I have this equation which I cannot, I cannot write down an effective Langevin equation for the x anymore because of these terms, but we can solve for this full probability distribution in the asymptotic limit again, so for large x and long t. Okay, and the solution looks like this. So if I had usual diffusion, I would have, so lambda equal to zero is my critical point, so if I ignore this part of it, if I just had normal dynamics, I had a quadratic free energy, all I would get here is pure diffusion, so this would have been x squared over t. Instead of that, you get the exponential mu star x. So it's by looking at it, you see immediately that it's going to give you extremely slow dynamics. So if lambda is zero, then at the critical point, this x grows as the logarithm of t. Okay, but the lambda gives you a cutoff point, well, a cutoff on the length scale. So if I just look at this, then I have two characteristic length scales, one that grows with t logarithmically, and then I have another length scale which is there for any finite lambda, which goes as 1 over square root of lambda. So if this length scale is much, much shorter than that, then the system essentially does, so I'm looking at a curve free energy, but the curvature is very small, so this lambda is huge. The system doesn't know that there's a cutoff, so it's just, the tilt is just going to grow as logarithm of t, but then at some point it gets cut off by this length scale. So I can then extract just a crossover time, so at what time scale do these two lengths become equal, and that time scale grows exponentially with 1 over square root of lambda. So this is the same behavior that we got from the saddle point analysis. So this exponential of 1 over square root of lambda for a crossover time or the longest time scale that I got for the correlation function all seem to have this behavior. I hope that once we have this, we can actually work out the full spectrum and get all the time scales. We haven't had time to do that yet. So this is the final result of all of these steps that we went through. So this result shows that in this three-color model, which is a frustrated model but has no quenching disorder, there's sort of a garden variety critical point. The thermodynamics of this model is not very unusual at all. I get some divergence of susceptibility, but the dynamics, because of these constraints, the dynamics is extremely slow, and the time scale goes up exponentially rather than as any power law. Okay, so let me just spend the next 2 minutes trying to make some connections and talking about future work. So this is the upshot of the model. So we succeeded in what we set out to do, which is to try and find a simple model where we can work out things. And this, I think, this is telling even more than, I guess, what's specific to the model. It's saying if you have, for some reason, this funny kind of partitioning of the rates, that you have energy on one side and entropy on the other side, it's characteristically will give you this. Because remember, in the continuum equation, I took sort of the simplest possible free energy, and all I did was put in these funny rates. Okay, so let me just make a connection to So there are these trap models that exist in the literature, and if I look at the barriers in our model, which are sort of exponential of the tilt, then we find that the distribution of the barriers has this form, and more than that, from what Jorge pointed out to me a couple of days ago, I think the barriers follow the same kind of trap-like dynamics that Jean-Philippe Bouchot has talked about. But if you look at the distribution of the barriers, or the distribution of the trapping times, then it has this log normal form, or the trapping time times the distribution has this log normal form. And interestingly, I think Dave Reichman was here at the conference, right? So he talked about this. This is the form that they find in the Leonard-Jones system, where Dave's not quite sure if this width increases as you approach the glass transition or the mode coupling temperature, but he does get this form with some hint that this width is growing. So it's intriguing to sort of speculate that maybe this kind of form has something to do with the real dynamics in real supercooled liquids. This becomes the trap model that quite a few of you know about, which is Bouchot's trap model, if lambda is zero. So exactly at lambda equal to zero, I sit at Bouchot's critical point. So the one thing that we have is that for any finite lambda, I reach a well-defined equilibrium state. And also, my dynamics is Langevin-like, so there is some connectivity in space. So I go from like one tilt to the next one. I don't arbitrarily sort of randomly sample the tilt. But we still get this form. Okay, so let me just end by, I'll forget about this. So, future work. So first of all, we are trying to work on this continuum model to extract, since I know the complete solution of the continuum model, I should be able to work out all the correlation functions. Aging in this infinite range model might or might not be interesting at all, but I think we still want to take a look at it and see what happens. Claudio Shimon has been looking at a version of this model where the interactions are local by mapping onto a spin model, and that would be extremely interesting to see. Once we have the continuum model, we can play around with all kinds of other barriers. Like, we have barriers which are growing exponentially as I go to farther away in my tilt space. But in the 80s, people looked at hierarchical distributions of barriers which are exactly solvable as long as this thing is flat, but not exactly solvable if you put them on a curved space. So the question of, would that give me some other kind of divergence of timescales? So once we have the continuum model, I think we can play around with those kinds of things. The parameter, can we try and ask what controls fragility in glasses? Is there something in this continuum model that we can tune which would make us go from, say, strong to fragile glasses? And then last, the connection to atomistic models like Leonard-Jones we are actually working on now by, again, looking at Leonard-Jones systems through a particular mapping onto these things called inherent structures and trying to extract the rates, just as we extracted the rates for our tilt in the three-color model. We could do a similar thing in the Leonard-Jones atomistic models and ask if it has any hint that this is the kind of partitioning of rates that it gets. Okay, so let me just end there.
Thank you very much.
We have time for some questions. Is there a simple way to make a sort of higher dimensional generalization
of this 2D?
And then look at some limit which would give you mean field theory, for example.
Instead of doing it infinite range, you're saying, can I make it higher dimensional?
Stay with the sort of.
I don't know how to do the constraints. There must be a way of doing it on some kind of underlying structure, but in three dimensions, for example, we haven't been able to come up with a good model where the constraints are rigidly enforced. Yeah. So we could do probably yeah. Well, one thing we are doing now is putting it on spheres, so you can have three colors on tilings on curved surfaces, and ask if there is anything interesting going on there, but we haven't done that sort of higher dimensional stuff.
The loop dynamics then becomes sort of surface.
Yes.
So that becomes a little complicated.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Comments or questions? No, let's thank you all one more time.